to our listeners. Welcome to the Women Governance Trailblazers podcast, where we listen to the journeys of trailblazing women in the corporate governance field, their passions, struggles, and commitment to improving how companies and boards function. My name is Liz Dunshee, and my co-host is Courtney Camlett.
Hi, everyone.
Courtney and I are both passionate about governance, and we want to spotlight some of the trailblazing women who share that passion. We love connecting with guests from different paths and industries to hear their perspectives on what surprised them in their career and where they think the field of corporate governance is going. For this episode, we are very excited to be talking with Jen Sisson. Jen is the CEO of the International Corporate Governance Network, otherwise known as ICGN, for those in the know. ICGN is led by investors responsible for assets worth over US$90 trillion, and it advances the highest standards of corporate governance and investor stewardship worldwide in pursuit of long-term value creation. Jen represents ICGN on the Japanese Financial Services Agency's Council of Experts and on the International Forum of Independent Audit Regulators Stakeholder Working Group. Jen joined ICGN from Goldman Sachs Asset Management, where she was head of stewardship for Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. And she oversaw voting, engagement, and industry collaboration activities in that region. Previously, she led policy outreach for the UK Financial Reporting Council on ESG audit and reporting matters, including the creation of the 2020 UK Stewardship Code and the 2018 UK Corporate Governance Code. Jen started her career at PwC, and she holds a BA in Business Accounting and Finance from the University of Newcastle and a Master's in Sustainability Leadership from the University of Cambridge. Welcome, Jen, and thank you for being here today.
Goodness, well, thanks for having me.
We are super excited to talk to you. Tell us a little more about ICGN's mission and what you've been focusing on to achieve it. I know our listeners will be particularly interested in who are ICGN members, any key activities that you guys do, anything else you want to share?
Great. Well, absolutely. So ICGM, for those who don't know, is basically a big global membership body for institutional investors. So most of our members are either pension schemes. So like in the US, some of your state pensions boards, like Florida State or CalPERS or CalSTRS or the New York City Retirement System, and their peers around the world, right? So like the Norwegian state funds, the GPIF in Japan, many of the Australian super funds, and then also the sort of big asset managers. So, usual suspects here, but you hear, BlackRock, Vanguard, Schroders, different BNP Paribas is where our chairman currently works, asset management in France, so they're all over the place. But really what we are is long-term investors who are interested in making sure that the market and the regulations and the rules of the game allow us to have good governance for our investee companies. So what we do is we focus on policy advocacy, so representing our member views in standard setting, both international standards and local standards in key markets. We do a lot of events and networking to share best practice and to do learning, because this is a very fast-moving market. And then we're a big network, so there's a good amount of networking, just like among the corporate side. I know company secretaries do that. I think that's a big value add as well. And we always say for ICGN, in the world of all the issues, G is key. So we're very much the G team, if you like, in the ESG, sustainability, investing space. This is really about, long-term investment, good governance, and that's what we're up to.
I like that. G is key.
Yeah, we have that on key rings, actually. If you want to come to one of our conferences,
Oh,
you can get some merch.
I missed that when I was at the ICGN conference last
Yeah.
summer, so I'll have to go to another one.
Yeah, I'll mail you one.
Okay. Well, from a corporate governance perspective, how do you think companies and investors should approach balancing global standards with local and business-specific nuances? Because as you mentioned, there are a lot of differences across the world. Do you think that there are areas of common ground that most companies and investors seem to agree on that can help with these conversations and moving the ball forward?
Absolutely. And I think, this is the great challenge of all of this nowadays, right? Which is that regulations and laws and local practices are local, right? But capital now is completely global, right? So investors are investing all over the world. And so how do you balance that, right? Between what is the sort of fundamental view that applies everywhere, and then what is the right kind of local application of that? Because at the end of the day, there is not one size fits all correct answer for how to do governance. Like every company is different, every country is different. And so I think investors are pretty pragmatic about the need for application. But what I would say is, on a principles level, there's a pretty broad, I think, and consistent view that, you know, the fundamental pillars of good governance, the goal of governance is the same everywhere. Exactly how you might apply that is going to need to be flexed. And so, you know, we always say we have our global principles. They're not rules, right? And so you have to take into account what are local market nuances. You know, laws are different. Annual general meeting structures are different. They just are. And so trying to pretend they're not doesn't do anyone any good. But one thing I think that's interesting, and I really observe, particularly in the more developed markets, right, in Europe, in the UK, in the US, is that lately it feels like we've all forgotten that we're really on the same team, and that like the rhetoric has become very kind of companies versus their investors. Like the shareholders own the companies. We're not trying to ruin companies. And so I think we're going to try and agree a bit more, actually, that investors and boards really have completely aligned goals, which is to have long-term successful companies generating value, right? And that good governance is there to help protect investors and to help drive value. And really, if we can kind of keep that unifying purpose in mind, I think actually often you find enormous amounts of common ground wherever you are in the world.
So drilling down one example that's a big topic in the US but does have a global lens, shareholder proposals. Could you give us some global context on how investors across the world are thinking about shareholder proposals and shareholder proposal rights and how that may affect how they approach investment decisions, engagements, and voting? And do you think there are lessons from how shareholder proposals work globally that could help us refocus our conversation here in the US on meaningful issues instead of sort of talking past each other?
Yeah, I think, do you know what? And this is such an important issue because it comes back again to this sort of nuance, right? And that it's, I think, a core belief of investors and of ICGM members that it is a fundamental right of ownership to be able to file proposals, right? And so the ability to file shareholder proposals, you know, is important to investors. The challenge, of course, is how do you use that in an appropriate way, right? And the nuance there becomes really important, right? Because not shareholder proposals are not all the same. And I think sometimes they get treated like a bit of a uniform thing. But we know that, for example, in the US, generally speaking, a shareholder proposal is an advisory proposal, right? Whereas in the UK, in Japan, in many parts of Europe, these tend to be binding proposals if they're seeking to make article changes. You know, if they're passed, they really do compel action. And again, that kind of depends on all sorts of different rules. The filing requirements are different. But what you tend to see in Europe, in India, in Singapore, in Japan, is that the threshold to file a shareholder proposal is much higher than it is in the US. But in the event that that proposal is successful, it is going to be binding so long as it's a well-written proposal. You can file a bad proposal anywhere, right? But let's take that off the table for the moment. And so they're often used in quite a different way. It takes much either a coalition of investors or someone to build quite a big position to file one. And so they'll tend to be often seen as quite an escalation, right? And so that's one thing. Now, in the US, of course, you have a different model where you have just advisory proposals. There's a much lower threshold in order to file one, but they're often used where engagement hasn't been possible, right? So it kind of comes at a different point in the cycle. And I think that can be tricky as well. But nuances aside, what is interesting is that if you look globally, in the world of shareholder proposals, then you could kind of break them down as being about, maybe they're about environmental issues, they're about social issues, they're about governance issues. The governance proposals tend to be much more successful everywhere. That's certainly true in the US, it's true outside of the US, because those are proposals that are typically directly tied to something material, where there is some kind of fundamental issue that's seeking to be changed, and you tend to get broader support for that. And so, I think it has to be taken in context to really understand this. And I think too often we just see the big number and we focus on the big number and we get a bit worried about it. But actually, what I think is important to remember is 2025, there were around, exact numbers going to depend on who was counting, which is interesting if you look across the various different reports, but about 500 shareholder proposals in the US, right? Only about 30 of which were actually successful. I mean, that is a vanishingly small percentage of all the votes count cast in the US, right? And we should remember that of all the agenda items in the US, you had a 96% management approval support rate last year, right? So I think we can sometimes use see these shareholder proposal numbers and read into it that there's a lot more dissent in the world than there really is. Right, and it becomes a big story. And I think they should be held in context because you can only vote on a shareholder proposal where it's been filed, right? And many of the most successful shareholder proposals don't hit the ballot because they are an engagement tool and you've had the conversation and the company's kind of understood, oh, hey, my investor's actually onto a good point here, right? So let's do it. And it's a sign of a good process. So I think it's really tricky. But I think we must remember that, it's important to care what your investors think. And so if you're getting shareholder proposals with high levels of support, I think, boards need to take that seriously and they need to kind of understand, well, maybe these guys are onto something here and be open to it. But I do think as a whole, we shouldn't let the, understandably, it's a heightened situation, but we shouldn't let that get in the way of the fact that actually most of the time engagement works pretty well. And most of the time voting is pretty supportive. So I do think it's a tricky one, but I think that if you take a big global context view, I think maybe that might bring a little bit of comfort sometimes to people who are worried about it.
Well, and I think it would be interesting from the SEC's perspective to see what is sort of really good practice and whether it's changing the US's to be more like Europe or Japan, or considering what does good look like when they're reformulating the processes.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. And look, I do think there's probably some unintended consequences to some of the things that have happened in the near term, right? So like the no action process at least was a process everybody understood, right? And it brought some certainty, it brought some consistency. And I think while I'm sure there are companies who didn't agree with the outcomes of that, at least we had a process that everyone knew. I think the uncertainty risks having some unintended consequences, and I don't think in the long run that helps anyone. And it's a bit like the changes around filing reports on your company engagement, right? Fundamentally, investors aren't going to stop voting. So the last thing we want to do is break the ability to have a feedback loop, right? We should be able to talk to each other about it. So I think, there's always room for improvement in everything everywhere, and everyone should be focused on how to make things better. And it may well be the case that actually you could sort of shift the balance a bit to a different model. But I think that has to be done in a way that respects the range of views and that respects shareholder rights. Because I do think there's a little bit of concern at the moment that there's a sort of degradation of shareholder rights happening, and that makes people nervous. And that's not really what you want if you're trying to create trust between boards and their shareholders and create a good environment for long-term investment.
Yeah, I think you made a good point too about how we are all on the same team fundamentally and pointing in the same direction. But when it comes to companies and when it comes to shareholders, it's also not monolithic. And so I think a lot of
Right.
what we end up arguing about is maybe bad actors at the margins. And Like some proponents don't negotiate at all. They put in a proposal, they haven't talked to you at all, and they still won't talk to you after they put in their proposal. And so that, I think companies appreciate the engagement, and a lot of times the good, quote unquote, good proposals that come from the proponents that are ICGN members are even things that the company has already been talking about doing or trying to do in some way. And so I think, yeah, a lot of times people are on the same page, but then we fight over like the abuse of the system by other folks.
Well, it's interesting. You kind of get these sort of, again, I think there are unintended consequences of literally everything, right? And so yeah, that but in the main, I think that's quite. I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that companies often feel like they get proposals on things they were already thinking about,
Oh,
right? That
yeah,
that's
absolutely.
great, right? Because they should be. Companies should be seeking to improve their governance and their long-term viability and sustainability and their capital allocation and their board succession, right? Of course, they should be thinking about that. That's a great thing. But yeah, I mean, I think you know what we mustn't do though is risk letting a very, in reality, very small number of things get in the way of what are fundamental rights. And I think that's always the concern, is like, where do you let the pendulum land, and for that you need good consultation processes, and you need people to actually listen to each other and to say, okay, well, where is the balance we can find that works for everyone, rather than to kind of run to one extreme of protectionism or one extreme of who's got the balance of power. I don't think that's really the way forward.
Yeah, I think companies want a durable and reliable process to going forward that they can count on. And yeah, the SEC change too has been, I think, challenging process-wise to everyone involved. But I will say, as someone who's kind of also on the capital formation side, I do believe that the staff had and has a big backlog that they're trying to work through, and the no action process takes a lot of bandwidth for them. So
Yeah,
yeah,
I think that's,
we're
I mean,
waiting like 75 days to get initial comments on registration statements.
oh
It's
goodness,
supposed to
yeah.
be 30 days. So it's like you said, unintended consequences everywhere you turn.
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it? Because it does all come in it's all of these things as individual things are one thing, but it's the sort of totality of it that kind of sets the mood, I think. And so yeah, like, look, I always say it's like reporting standards, right? Investors know reporting's not free, right? Investors, like, we're not looking for companies to spend money on stuff we don't need, right? And so the question should be like, what's the balance here? Like, what is material? And that has to be a joint decision, right? Like, if the investors think it's material, it's material, right? But like, let's focus on the important stuff and get that done, because yeah, there's a huge amount of process and backlog on everybody, right? Everybody has a lot going on, so
Well,
maybe it's maybe we'll get there. I
I
hope
hope
so.
so.
And sometimes you have to break things to fix them. And I think this process has been broken for a while. And so, maybe the only way to fix it really is to just break it and change it. Time
Yeah,
will
maybe
tell.
that's right. And I think it'll be a good test of, can we all actually remember we really are on the same team and like come to some tables with open ears and open minds and actually kind of talk and listen and see where we can get to. And governance people should be good at that, right? We talk, this is what we do. We talk about things.
Theoretically, yes.
Yes.
Well, Jen, how do you think a typical long-term institutional investor wants companies to think about financial activism in terms of which defensive measures could be appropriate or not appropriate, and how to respond to financial activists in a way that keeps shareholder value front of mind?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because this is another one where I know you guys are in the US and that is where often the focus is. But actually, you see activism kind of moving around the world in terms of where there's more of it, where there's less of it. And again, I think there's as many different types of activists as there are any other actor, right? So it's difficult to be like super general, but what I would say is I think long-term investors want to evaluate what activists are doing based on the specifics of the company, right? And the fact that they are an activist or not, maybe in and of itself isn't the key issue, right? And so a lot of the time, activists are pointing out opportunities to change things that are broadly pretty reasonable requests, right? And they're pretty sensible. And like, you know, you don't have enough independence on your board, or maybe you haven't got an optimum capital strategy, right? And the fact that they are an activist isn't make them wrong. And so, how can we kind of think about what is the right answer is important. And then, you know, it's really interesting again that you see where are the campaigns that are more successful. They do tend to be about board changes on boards that don't have what would generally be considered the right structure, or they're about capital allocation issues where there are different views of how you can do a value story there. And so if I was a company, I'd want to be proactively thinking about whether my governance really is right, right? Like just defending the status quo might not always be the right thing to do. Are we making the right disclosures? Do we have a long-term engagement with our core long-term shareholders, right? Because the last thing you want is to not know anyone and then have an activist campaign and then have to kind of scramble around, right? Like if you've got good, trusted, long-term relationships and you're used to doing engagement and you're not always going to agree on everything, but you're willing to listen and your shareholders know that you're trying to do good governance and you're trying to think about the long run, they're going to be more bought in, I think. And transparency, disclosure, engagement, it sounds like an easy answer, but I actually think that is probably the best defense against an unreasonable demands. Now, the other thing is, of course, they're not all unreasonable, right? But what is very interesting, if we look around the world, right, is actually Korea has been a fascinating case study for governance policy this year. And I know you, again, your listeners are probably mostly American, but if you have some time, I would take a look, right? The new government in Korea came in on a real agenda of governance reform, right? We're going to increase the ability for minority shareholders to vote, independent directors onto boards. We're going to change fiduciary duties so that there's a clear link to all shareholders. And what we've seen is activism rates drop massively, right? Because when governance generally is better, you have less activism. And similarly, we didn't actually really see massively more success in activism in 2025, right? And they tend to be in the same areas. So I would say the best defense is good governance, actually. Like you don't necessarily need any tricks. You just need to be confident about what you're doing, thoughtful and transparent and well engaged. And I think that's the best thing that you can do.
Well, when speaking about good governance, what excites you now about corporate governance at this moment?
So I would say the exciting parts of the world for governance are the developing Asian markets, I would say. That's where all the like boom times for governance are happening, right? I'm a bit worried. I'm worried about the US, I'm worried about the UK, I'm worried about Europe because we're in this little bit of a maybe we can pare back things, right? Like it's been a long time since the financial crisis. Maybe we can get some growth with some deregulation, and that just makes everyone a little bit heightened and a little bit nervous. But if we look to Asia, you know, Singapore, Malaysia, I heard recently Vietnam, Taiwan, India, right? Korea, as I just mentioned, fantastic. Japan, a long way down this journey now, but with great progress too. These are governments and markets saying, hey, we want to raise standards of governance because we believe this will create trust. And it's like really paying dividends. And we're seeing it happen. And we're seeing kind of what we all know in the US and here in London and around the world, we know this stuff is important and we know it drives value, right? And we're really seeing it pick up across Asia. So I think that's super exciting. The other thing I think that's exciting, and this comes back to my G is key thing, right? I think it's quite exciting that we're having a slight shift back to the fundamentals, right? And that we're going to say, actually, why are we like, let's remember what we're all doing here, right? Maybe we can stop arguing at the fringes and we can remember that this is all about long-term value creation, right? And it's about, it's about paying people's pensions at the end of the day, right? Whether it's your 401k or it's, a foundation investing for their future. Like really at the end of the day, we're all trying to do the right thing. And how can we remember this is about value? How can we like get back to core principles and work together? And I think, maybe we come out of this slightly turbulent period a bit more on the same page. I think that would be something to be super psyched about.
Yeah, we can hope. I do think it's encouraging that there's been more of a return to first principles and boards thinking about how they can actually oversee a company in an effective way to identify risks and opportunities and what structures support that. So,
I
yeah,
think so.
I hope that continues.
I hope so too. And I hope because I think if we just have a race to the bottom, that it's not going to be good for anyone, right? So the question's got to be like, how can we all get around the table a bit better? But I think if we look to markets that are seeking to be competitive, that tells me that, the future is in good governance and we just need to kind of keep our eyes on the prize.
Well, you've had a lot of experience over the course of your career, as I noted in our introduction. What advice would you give to the next generation of women governance trailblazers?
Well, I think this is interesting because I think what is definitely true is that anybody whose career is the next 20 years, their career is going to look different than ours all has in the last 20 years, right? And so it's interesting, but I think there's some core things. Again, it's like, there's core principles that I do believe are relevant. What I have said when I, and I thought about this a bit, I think I say two things, right? First of all, is like, be a proper expert at something, right? Like really know in detail. I think the era of the like broad generalist might be behind us. And then what you need is to be someone who's like the go-to person on the thing, right? And you're always going to, as you get more senior, you're always going to have to pick up other stuff, and that's the nature of life. But for me, I started my career in audit at PwC, right? And I've worked now, and it's a long time since I've done any of that. But like the ability to really understand the nuts and bolts of like, how does reporting work and how does assurance work? And like, what am I actually asking somebody for when I'm asking them to disclose something? I think has been very useful to me. And to like, I have colleagues, there are many stewardship people who are lawyers, right? And it's helpful to them that they like, they really get it and they understand the legal nuance of what we're asking and what we're doing. And my sense is that those types of proper deep expertise pieces will remain important, even if the way that it gets deployed changes. The other thing that I think is really important and has certainly been absolutely critical for me in my career is like, you gotta network hard. Right. And you have to like, don't network in a way that's like surface level. Right. Some of the best colleagues I've ever had are people that they're my friends. Right. And you should be able to make lots of friends in the industry because like we have a lot in common usually. Right. You're interested in the same kinds of things. People are smart. And as I said before, like governance people are usually pretty good talkers. And so like you should talk to people and like, AI can't have a conversation. Maybe it can have a conversation with itself. I don't really understand that. But like what I know for sure is true is there's always going to be a company secretary, or there's always going to be a Remco chair, and there's always going to be a person on the asset management side. And the best thing is for them to just talk to each other. And so getting good at talking to people and listening to people and getting to know as many different people as you can is I think the best way to set yourself up because it's a remarkably small world, right? And then you're going to run across people over and over again. So it's always lovely when we have our conferences. I say it's like I get to hang out with 400 of my friends next week. This is going to be great. And I think that's what makes it such a nice industry, and one that you can really find your way through productively if you put the time in.
Yeah, Liz and I both spend a lot of time now. In fact, that's how we met was networking with our peers and eventually each other. But it is extremely important. I agree.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks, Jen, for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been great.
It's been very insightful. And for those who are listening, we want to thank you as well. Please subscribe to Women Governance Trailblazers on whatever platform you use for podcasts, and we would love if you would rate us while you're there. In addition, if you know a Women Governance Trailblazer who you think would be a great guest on the show, feel free to ping Liz or me on either LinkedIn or by email.